Welcome to the Newsbusters podcast with the executive editor of Newsbusters, your host, Tim Graham.
Hello and welcome to the huddle of the News Analysis Nerd Squad. We're not normal people, quote unquote. Bill D'Agostino, our up-and-coming nerd with all the video skills, has a new video explainer of the HR1 voting rights bill. As you know, this has become a project of ours to focus on the media bias on voting rights.
First of all, let's get this out of the way. The bill has nothing to do with Jim Crow. Anyone making that claim is trying to sell you a political narrative. Even the Washington Post admits Georgia's voting law is less strict than what's on the books in some deep blue states. Delaware, Washington, Connecticut all have stricter voting laws, to name a few.
Yeah, so it combines the voting rights issue we're focusing on, and now we're trying to start a new practice of having explainer videos on the issues of the day with the media and politics. So rush over to Newsbusters. You can scroll down just a little bit to our must-read section and give Bill's video a gander. Now, I did want to talk about this today. On Wednesday, Washington Post media columnist Margaret Sullivan had a column, and the headline was, "Bad News for Journalists. The Public Doesn't Share Our Values." To which most conservatives would say, duh. Our values should be everyone's values. A new poll from the so-called Media Insight Project is quote-unquote disturbing. The poll quote in the Post, in the paper, was, "Only one of five core values touted by journalists also shares support of a majority of Americans." This is disturbing because all Americans are supposed to be exactly like the media. The media have been trying to bend, shape, and mold Americans to their viewpoint for decades, and somehow the resistant public just isn't knuckling under like they should. So Margaret Sullivan lists them this way. These are the big five. Oversight. We're the watchdogs keeping an eye on government officials and other powerful people and institutions. Transparency. We believe it's best to put information out in the open, not keep it hidden. Factuality. It's crucial to provide as much accurate information as possible to get to the truth. Spotlighting wrongdoing. We think society's problems are best solved by exposing them to public criticism. Their big slogan there is, sunlight is the best disinfectant. Now, you do hear that in the journalism school. Sunlight. The media equates themselves to the sun. And that apparently means the media critics are the clouds. And then finally, giving a voice to the voiceless. Margaret says, it's our job to advocate for those lacking power or social standing. Her phrase that pays here is, afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. We could spend a half hour, maybe an hour, on how much that phrase stinks as a model for journalism. We'll give you the short version. That's basically saying, afflict who we think is too powerful, and comfort the powerless as we define who the powerless is. It's a recipe for self-righteous leftist bias. Afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted is at war with spotlighting wrongdoing with these other things. Factuality, no. I'm sorry. The afflicted can never do anything wrong, and the facts have to be arranged so that they afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. So Margaret here is touting a study, the Associated Press is part of this huddle, titled A New Way of Looking at Trust in Media. The people inside the liberal media are upset because obviously media properties aren't as popular as they used to be. They aren't as profitable as they used to be. They're being bought by billionaires, by Jeff Bezos, to keep them afloat. Well, it becomes apparent in looking over this study that the media is trying to find a way to say what they want to say. It's not an ideological thing, this mistrust in the media. It's not that we're blatant partisans. It must be something else that's hurting our reputation. And when you criticize them for being liberals, well, that's just unfair. How could you possibly say such a thing? And why are you so much against the public interest and the right to know and every other journalistic value they say that they're on behalf of? Well, you know, the first turnoff for a lot of people is the media's moral superiority.
But I want to be clear. There's a lot of negative partisanship that happens on the left as well. Disdain and nastiness directed at the right. This is happening in all directions, but it is especially extreme, especially vitriolic on the right, directed at Joe Biden.
Margaret, of course, for a quote, goes to Tom Rosenstiel, who used to be a reporter for the Los Angeles Times, a media reporter, and also was a reporter for Newsweek. He's now, for a while now, been executive director of the American Press Institute. And his quote in the Post is, "Journalism is a tribe. These are our core values, and we think everybody shares them." He also finds it disturbing that people don't all have the same values that the journalists do. This is the same guy, Tom Rosenstiel, that I sat with in an NPR studio in D.C. in the fall of 2000, or maybe the summer. We were discussing coverage of the 2000 presidential campaign, and Al Gore in particular, on the Diane Rehm show. The one time I was on the Diane Rehm show, and the funniest part of that story is, when it was over, she went like running for the elevator, like, who let these vandals into my studio? So we're in the middle of this discussion, and they went to one of these breaks where they can either promote other NPR shows or talk about their underwriters and not call it advertising. Tom Rosenstiel leans over to me and said, "Can we not talk about liberal bias here? Liberals never seem to understand. Hey, this is my job, pal. This is my gig. It's what I do. I read the media and watch the media and tell you what's wrong with it." This is a little like rolling over and saying to an environmentalist, "Excuse me, Sierra Club, can we not talk about the polluters? Polluters aren't what's wrong with the environment." But Rosenstiel, you know, underlines their shared viewpoint here about the study. "This at least opens a new window. It gets us out of the endless loop." The endless loop is the discussion about media bias is part of the trust problem. It's something they simply do not want to engage. They don't want to admit or acknowledge that that's a problem. They can look at these polls and say trust in the so-called mainstream media is in single digits among conservatives, and it's like 73% among liberals. What does that mean? It says you're pleasing the liberals every day. They think you're fantastic. Because you guys all seem to share core values of journalism? Or is it core values of your shared ideology? Oh, let's not go into that endless loop. Look, the first problem with media trust in our eyes is their almost religious devotion to crusading for liberalism and then pretend it isn't ideology that they're pushing. Oh, it's their journalistic values. They're not trying to defeat Trump. They're just trying to defend reality.
I'm terribly concerned that when you talk about the New York Times these days, when you talk about the Washington Post these days, we're not talking about the New York Times of 50 years ago. We are not talking about the Washington Post of 50 years ago. We're talking about organizations that I believe have, in fact, decided as organizations that Donald J. Trump is bad for the United States. We have things appearing on the front page of the New York Times right now that never would have appeared 50 years ago. Analysis, commentary, on the front page.
Reality's under attack. We are sticking up for realness. The air we breathe, the street we walk on, Trump doesn't believe in those. We have to stick up for it. I mean, Margaret was in this habit of calling themselves the reality-based press. And we can point and say to them, how did your collusion narrative work out? Did that turn out to be reality? That Trump was somehow had been a Russian agent for decades or whatever sort of crap you were throwing. How about that Russian bounties narrative? How's that working out?
I mean, if this Times report is correct, this means that U.S. intelligence has concluded that Vladimir Putin is offering bounties for the scalps of American soldiers in Afghanistan.
Believe Russia placed bounties on American troops?
Well, I would say first that we felt the reports were enough of a cause of concern that we wanted our intelligence community to look into those reports as a part of this overall assessment. They assessed with low to moderate confidence. They assessed with low to moderate confidence, as you alluded to, that Russian intelligence officers sought to encourage Taliban attacks against U.S. and coalition personnel in Afghanistan.
We're the reality-based press. Well, it seems to me that now that Biden is safely president, it's okay for liberal press institutions to go, well, maybe we didn't get everything right last year.
Given that assessment, does the president have any regrets for how many times he attacked President Trump on the campaign about this issue for not taking action related to the Russian bounties?
Well, I'm not going to speak to the previous administration.
Maybe we kind of went too hard on the Russians, and now that Biden's in there, maybe we won't be as hard on the Russians, although Biden is trying here to look tough on the Russians. It's not what Obama Biden was. If Russia and Ukraine go to war, what's going to happen? Do you think Biden's going to be any more resistant to Russia than Obama was?
Indeed, I firmly believe that America's most significant national security interests and priorities could be advanced most effectively through cooperation, not an adversarial relationship with Russia. That's why I committed to resetting the relationship between our two nations.
My last election, basically.
Yeah.
After my election, I have more flexibility.
I transmit this information to Vladimir.
Anyway, yeah, this is a habit with Margaret Sullivan, is this whole notion of we're the reality people. We're the democracy people. She wrote a piece, the column right after the election, November 8, 2020, and the headline was, on the website anyway, "The media never fully learned how to cover Trump," meaning they didn't get him impeached or destroyed before he was up for re-election. "But they still might have saved democracy, because journalism is all about saving democracy. Liberalism and journalism are basically the same thing." That's where they won't say that out loud, but everything they do seems to underline that. "We're giving voice to the voiceless, but that's not liberalism. That's just fairness." She quotes a fan letter in this November column. She quotes some Trumper basically saying 4 more years of Trump. That's apparently the conservative media critic's position. And then she quoted a fan letter. "It was the free press which kept our focus, which allayed our fears of demagoguery and autocracy, without which we would be just another disenfranchised country." This underlines why these people hate new bills about voting, because if the Democrats don't win, we don't have a democracy. We have a disenfranchised country.
MRC-store.com.
Pro-gun, pro-life, pro-God, and pro-America? Welcome to the Pro Shop.
MRC-store.com. MRC-store.com.
T-shirts, hoodies, goodies, and much more.
MRC-store.com.
The only store that always offers conservatives more.
That's MRC-store.com.
Log on, log in, and help the Media Research Center while shopping for great gear today.
MRC-store.com.
Now, one of Saul Alinsky's rules for radicals was, make the enemy live up to its own book of rules. Now, let's not, they're going to say, oh, see, you say the press is the enemy. They're enemy of the people. I don't say the press is the enemy of the people, but they certainly seem to have arrayed themselves as enemies of Trump. In that case, they become enemies of a Republican president. Certainly, they are enemies of conservatism. They don't want it to win. They want liberalism to win. So let's try to play this game. How does these book of rules that the media has rolled out here, how are they working? How are they valuing their own values? Do they really live up to them every day? So let's run through the list. Oversight. What are we doing at Newsbusters? Media critics are the watchdogs keeping an eye on the media. Because the media is an all-powerful institution today. They think they have the power to save democracy, so they can't be criticized? That is democracy. You say your piece, we say ours. And what they say is, no, we're going to shut down your Twitter account. Look today at the Post story on Tucker Carlson is the bully pundit. Underlining that Tucker Carlson criticizing the press leads to violence and threats. In a caption, the Post dared to quote Fox News, saying, no public figure or journalist is immune from legitimate criticism of their reporting, claims, or journalistic tactics. They're quoting this like it's hate speech, like it's objectionable. Let's listen to those words again. No public figure or journalist is immune from legitimate criticism of their reporting, claims, or journalistic tactics. They're going to really disagree with that? I mean, the story itself is kind of funny. I mean, Chris Plant was talking about this story on the radio here today. And he's like, well, wait. They're upset that Tucker Carlson is launching attacks on journalists when this story itself is a long attack on a journalist. Oh, but wait. Conservatives can't be journalists. That seems to be the principle. Fox News isn't journalism. Fox News is propaganda.
Let's go on a trip together to a totally alternative universe. You never hear what's happening there unless you tune into right-wing talk radio. But you need to know what they are saying because the most popular, most powerful talkers in the country have trained their sights on Joe Biden. What you are about to hear them say is mind-boggling. Look, whether you like Biden or not, this stuff is offensive and otherworldly.
When Trump is president, or even now that he's granting interviews to Fox as not president, Fox is state-run TV. But if NBC or ABC or CBS puts on Joe Biden or Hunter Biden or Kamala Harris and treats them like they're wonderful human beings, that's not state-run TV. Well, you certainly can't call it oversight. You certainly can't call it transparency. You certainly can't call it spotlighting wrongdoing. You can't call it giving voice to the voiceless. When does that ever happen? With these people, with Biden or Harris or Schumer or Pelosi. You can't challenge them. You're not saving democracy when you do that. All right, so this is my problem, is that the media think they're for oversight, but they don't want to be overseen. Transparency. How well is the media doing in being transparent? I mean, look at this collapsing story on the Russian bounties. Who were their sources at the New York Times when they broke this story last summer? Anonymous government sources. So the Daily Beast suggests Donald Trump might be right. This Russian bounties thing may be a myth. Based on what? We had a phone call with sources in the Biden administration. So coming and going, we're being told how our government is being run by anonymous people. And yet they come to us and they say, we are the titans of transparency? Now, the obvious question for Margaret, if she was going to stand up at a podium like Jen Psaki, my first question would be, okay, you say you're for transparency, then why would the Washington Post remove its entire news archive from the Nexus search system so we can't study their content?
I don't have anything new for you on that, and we'll circle back with you directly.
That's not transparency. That's the opposite of transparency. That's them taking their little ball and going home with it and hiding it in a closet, putting it under something in the garage. Margaret Sullivan's career underlines the way transparency is going in the media today. She used to be the ombudsman, or they called it the public editor, at the New York Times to establish a channel of communication for the public's complaints about media coverage. Now, usually when the Washington Post had an ombudsman or the New York Times had a public editor for a while, the NPR still has a public editor. What you're basically getting there is a liberal journalist inside a liberal newsroom having a discussion with other liberals, and half the time, if not more than half the time, they're discussing how they have not adequately served the underserved. We haven't adequately given voice to the voiceless, or we have been racially insensitive in our terminology and need to bow more to the politically correct terminology. It's not, they're not in business to discuss liberal bias for the most part. But at least they sometimes can discuss some of these problems we're having, like anonymous sourcing is a media issue. Well, guess what happened? After Margaret Sullivan was public editor, they had one or two after her, the New York Times abolished the office of public editor. Marty Baron comes to the Washington Post in the Obama years and abolishes the ombudsman. Margaret Sullivan comes to the Washington Post under Marty Baron. She's not there to be an ombudsman. She's there to be a media columnist. And really what she is now is an anti-ombudsman. She's an anti-public editor because she's basically saying, look at this column. The public is wrong. The public doesn't understand us. And it's very upsetting and disturbing. The public hasn't yet come around to our point of view. Now, does that sound like someone who would try to be a bridge between the audience and the reporters? No, it's the reporter lecturing the audience that they're so inadequate. Don't come and talk to us about transparency when everything in the press in recent years has been about denying us transparency. So we're in Margaret, we're getting someone who drops bombs on anyone who dares to question the perfection of journalism, at least from the conservative side. So the problem in terms of Margaret, when she talks about spotlighting wrongdoing, she talks about people who value loyalty and authority. And those people somehow just don't get how journalism operates. Except journalists expect to be respected as an authority. They're upset that they're not viewed as authoritative. They expect loyalty to their values. But it's obvious that their function is often undermining authority. By spotlighting wrongdoing, they undermine authority. Are they improving the police right now? Or are they driving defunding the police? I mean, the Washington Post has a story this week on a so-called community protection group in a Native American section of the Twin Cities. And they're sort of asking the question, is this better? Is this better than the police? Or does it reinforce the status quo? Now, the question doesn't seem to be asked in this piece. What happens when these alternative police kill somebody? I mean, they tout these people carrying around Glocks and putting up roadblocks. It's okay, apparently, if you're a member of a minority group in a minority neighborhood, to have a counter police or an alt police. And so this is part of it, is we have reporting right now on the police that's rather incessant, whether it's in Minneapolis, in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota. Now they're discussing again a 13-year-old Latino kid being shot in Chicago. And the mayor of Chicago gets to get up and proclaim how horrible it is. And nobody in the liberal press says, why does this keep happening under a Democratic mayor? Oh, Democratic mayors are never responsible for violence in large cities, whether it's rioting, whether it's more regular robbing, looting, and crime. The Democratic mayors are never responsible. And that's the media, and obviously that's the voters in these Democratic cities. Because the Democrats in Democrat cities keep voting for Democrats. And then they come and complain to us about systemic racism or systemic poverty or systemic crime in a system that never really has competition. The media saved democracy in one-party large cities. There's not even any competition. So let's go back to giving a voice to the voiceless. I'm the voiceless. Brent Bozell is the voiceless. You know, conservatives are routinely the voiceless in liberal journalism, and that's especially true of the conservative critics of the media. I mean, most reporters seem to think conservatives can't be experts, just like they think Tucker Carlson doesn't count as a journalist. I pay for National Public Radio. I've been here a long time. I don't think I've ever, ever been interviewed by NPR's media reporter, David Folkenflik, right now. And David and I will go around and around on Twitter and pick on each other a little bit. But David's never interviewed me for a story on the media, I don't think. See if he can correct me on that. We've called for defunding at least the taxpayer portion of National Public Radio. So we're the last people who are going to get on National Public Radio. We are voiceless because apparently we're against saving democracy. We think taxpayers shouldn't fund biased journalism, and then what the NPR people get is more biased journalism. Because who funds NPR other than the involuntary taxpayers and a bunch of woke corporations? Well, there's a lot of liberals that are funding NPR because they get liberalism spat back to them. They get very upset. They basically cast out Juan Williams because he wasn't right enough. He wasn't liberal enough. He was just too contrarian. They can't have contrarian people at NPR. Oh, they can have people in NPR who like trash Christianity. That's not, well, that doesn't upset them. You just can't say, I'm afraid of getting on a plane. Well, this is what got Juan Williams. I get a little concerned when somebody in a traditional Muslim attire gets on a plane.
I think, look, political correctness can lead to some kind of paralysis where you don't address reality. I mean, look, Bill, I'm not a bigot. You know, the kind of books I've written about the civil rights movement in this country. But when I get on a plane, I got to tell you, if I see people who are in Muslim garb, and I think, you know, they're identifying themselves first and foremost as Muslims, I get worried. I get nervous. Now, I remember also that when that Times Square bomber was at court, I think this is just last week, he said the war with Muslims, America's war with Muslims, is just beginning. First drop of blood. I don't think there's any way to get away from these facts.
That was completely unacceptable. Something he probably shouldn't have said if he wanted to stay at NPR. What liberals really mean when they talk about giving voice to the voiceless is whoever we decide the voiceless are going to be. Now, that's usually what they would call the less fortunate or the underclass. But only that section of the underclass that have the approved grievances. So if black members of the underclass are punching Asians on us on the street, well, that's not really the underclass. Because if a black person punches an Asian on the street, that's white supremacy, right? I think we can all smell the white supremacy in that. According to the people who say they're all about factuality. Now, the notion of factuality, this is where this AP Media Insight poll found the most support. People would like journalism to be fact-based. But the problem for liberal journalism today is their opinions are more important than the facts. Their self-righteousness is more important than the facts. And they're going to very carefully select for you the facts they think you need to know and crush the facts they don't like. The biggest bias we have right now, if you turn on the television, is story selection. It's not that the news is unfactual. It's that these are the stories we're going to do. So we're going to obsess over George Floyd dying in the street in police custody. And we're going to make that around the clock, 24/7, cover every minute of the trial, and then talk about the trial when the trial's not on. You know, I don't like that I turn on the TV at night and it's like, and now more live coverage of riots. Like that won't encourage more rioting. You know, is that, again, are they undermining society or are they helping society? Are they shining a spotlight in wrongdoing like a bunch of heroes? Or is it possible that if you own a store that gets trashed and burned to the ground, you might think, I don't think the media helped me. I'm sort of skeptical that the media are the heroes in my life. And the sad thing about all of this is that if we decided, oh, there's rioting in New York City and we're going to all break into 30 Rock and steal stuff out of the NBC store, they still wouldn't get the point. NBC's own reporters get attacked by Antifa and NBC says nothing. This happens right now. CNN's producer gets hit in the head. CNN says nothing. So they run around and scream that Tucker Carlson's getting journalists hurt or Donald Trump's going to get journalists hurt, saying CNN sucks is going to get journalists hurt. And then when left-wingers actually hurt journalists, they say nothing? How is that transparency? How is that spotlighting wrongdoing? How is that oversight of Antifa? These people are not interested in these principles that they say they are. Otherwise, they would do a better job of it. They have to engage with these complaints that they are biased and that they are propagandists. And they have to understand them. They're not willing to sit and listen and understand. We, on the other hand, sit here all the time and watch them 8 hours a day, and generally, we're the voiceless because we kind of just yell at the TV and they can't really hear what we're saying. What we're saying, you can actually see at Newsbusters. So come see us once, twice, 24 times a day. Rant ended. Thank you for listening. Journalism matters, but we like fairness too.